You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I think you're going to enjoy today's pod with Toby Stewart, who is the Leo Helzel Chair in Entrepreneurship and Innovation at the Haas School of Business, UC Berkeley. He's also held named professorships at Harvard, Columbia, and right here at the University of Chicago. He has a terrific new book. It's called Anointed, The Extraordinary Effects of Social Status in a Winner-Take-Most World. Enjoy the pod. Toby Stewart, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm really excited to be here.
So I'm reading the book, and I'm flashing on something that happened a while back in my life at the Second City. So I had produced a show, or was producing a show, called Between Barack and a Hard Place. So Barack Obama was had just won the primary, so he was not president, he was running. And the show was up, and it was very prescient, this very diverse cast, played Barack at different points because the idea was that everyone sees themselves in Barack. Michelle had come to a preview. I got to hang out with her. She loved it. She convinced him to come. So Secret Service comes. They do what they do, which is a lot of putting weird bags under things around the theater. That's weird. So I and our owner, Andrew Alexander, we go down to meet him on Wells Street, and he's very demure and very thankful that we're hosting him. It was like a fundraiser. And so, great. We had a lovely experience. He was very professional, and he's like, could I meet the cast before? We're like, yeah, we're going to take you right up here. And as he enters the green room, posture completely changes, and he's like, he says this. He goes, you guys. And it's like he pivoted in a minute. It did not feel inauthentic. I have to say that up top. It felt a little masterful, but it also felt like, oh, this guy knows that every audience is different. And especially when you're running for president, you're talking to all these different audiences. And I read a line, or I noted a line from your book. You say, quote, although we might not rehearse each of our lines, we almost always adjust how we present ourselves to conform to the expectations of our audiences and the context at hand. So my story is illustrative of that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I love it on so many levels. One is, all my years in Chicago, so now I'm thinking about Wells Street and where exactly you are. And the first time I ever went to see improv at Second City, which was absolutely amazing. So, I wish we were doing this live there next time, okay?
Yeah.
So we live our lives on a stage of sorts, and we go through this series of vignettes, most of us every day. Like, we walk into these different worlds, if you think about it. Like, you go into the office and that's one thing, and you're at home or you're with a group of friends or you're at a show or you're in a show or you're whatever. So your life rotates, and as it rotates, you move through these different social worlds, and we behave differently in them. And we do in ways that kind of conform to expectations of us. And those expectations are much broader than just status-based, but many of them are indeed status-based. And so sort of where we are in a hierarchy and who we are very much affects how we behave. And oftentimes, and I think maybe this is what you're getting at, it's just like, so you're running for president and that, like, I can't even imagine that, because it is indeed like so difficult because there are so many people to please. Right. And you're not going to, at least if you care, if you please anyone, but we all, you know, we indeed do that. And many of us just do it reflexively. Like it just, it's part of our, it's programmed into us.
Yeah. So I'm a little obsessed with Goffman.
Well, you know that.
I'm such a nerd. So when I came across his work, you know, he uses these theatrical metaphors, which immediately made sense to me. And they made sense to me, not just because I've lived my life in theater, but also because why was theater invented? It was invented to be a mirror of human behavior and human society and systems and status and all these things that, that we see. So that seems to me to make perfect sense. And my wife, Anne, is she works at Second City, but she's a professor of comedy and obsessed by status. And if you think for, in a comedy sense, of course, it was status is always there. But you think in the duos, right? You know, whether it's Hope and Crosby, you know, or any of those, that there's always a high status and low status, and low status guys win. And so, the title of your book, Anointed, is interesting because it. I mean, this book is about status, and the way it gets sort of wielded for good or ill. But I think the important thing is you cannot escape it. It's inevitable. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, couldn't have said it better. So it's everywhere, you know, seemingly everywhere. It's in places where you don't really think about it. It has all these impacts on our life that most of us never really contemplated. And so a lot of the book is about that. It's meant to be revelatory. Like, you know, this is operating in the background. It's influencing all these things that matter to you. So, you know, it's worth thinking more about. And that's exactly right. You're not going to avoid it.
So I think we should sort of, and you dive into this in the book, is why this exists. Because here's a thing I've learned in my 59 years of being on the earth is I had an underappreciation for the fact that I don't know what's going on and that really like no one does. It's too complicated. And so I thought the Cornell University research that you cite, they claimed we make 227 decisions each day about food alone.
Yeah,
that's nuts. And I, as I thought about it in my various food situations during the day, I'm like, this is true.
It is true. So we make and we do them like there are all these cognitive cues. Okay, so we make so many decisions a day, You know, when you write a book, you also get pretty reflective and auto, you know, like a lot of this ends up being about you. So I find myself to be particularly terrible at decision making. Mm-hmm. And I find myself to waste like this is an incredible amount of time on decisions that don't matter, like what to have, you know, just completely befuddled by a food court. Like, you know, what am I going to eat? you know, all of it.
Befuddled by a food court would have been a great title. Just so you know.
I mean, all of it and none of it. and none of it looks good at the same time. And the thing about choice is, like in the modern world, it's infinite because, you know, what I think of now is like, I have this bad habit that probably every single person listening does, which is I wake up and I look at my phone. Mm-hmm. And if you wake up and you look at your phone, that's a portal into the most like incomparably immense content stream. Like there's literally no end to what you could look at on your phone. So you never have to get out of bed again. Mm-hmm. And you could literally spend the entirety of your life viewing the content that's posted in the 2 minutes that you look at your phone before you get up and do something else. Like, and so that just kind of raises a question of like, and yet we do it and we don't tend to spend hours, like, you know, we don't sit there and think, okay, there's, you know, 18 billion things I can look at right now. Which one of those am I going to look at? We just look at something, and that's the role of habit. And that's the role of, you know, what we think of as consideration sets, which is like, we're only actually thinking about looking at a couple of things. Like, you know, I get up and this is me. I look at the New York Times first typically. And then, and maybe I look at LinkedIn. I don't spend a lot of time on the socials, but like I have my things and their, and their habit, but there's also just curation. And so much of the status dynamic that we don't see is about what in fact we ever see in the first place. Like, I mean, comedy is a great example. Like every time I've walked into some comedy venue in some random place where there are six people in the audience, I've laughed my ass off.
Right.
Like, I mean, I really don't remember not doing that. Mm-hmm. There are so many great comics, but they're not comedians, but they're not going to see the light of day, right? I mean,
most
of it's toiling away in oblivion, right? And then you know, I saw Ricky Gervais live a little while ago, and then there's Ricky Gervais, right? I mean, and there's mm-hmm. there's the small set of the anointed who won, and so I think the broad point about I think where you were headed is there's this status process that curates what you ever even see in the first place.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I sat in that role at Second City for about a little over 20 years, picking the talent, right? And you're a gatekeeper, and it's a wild responsibility. And it's, I mean, you know, my first cast was Colbert, Carell, and Amy Sedaris. So it was like, I kind of came out of the gate, and it's not like, what's hilarious about that, right? Is I didn't train these people. I didn't, like, everyone else knew how good they were. I just happened to be the guy in the seat at the time. And you know, Saturday Night Live just did their run through, and three of our people got called back, and we were sure that some of them were going to get hired. They didn't, you know, and that becomes its own kind of thing.
But I got to interrupt you before you go, because now we have to stop, because that's just so cornerstone to the book, because effectively what you are, and you know, people who are listening, I assume know this, but I'm not sure the whole world knows. It's like how influential your organization is, which by definition, like, this is the training ground in comedy, right? This is mm-hmm. where people come through. And when they come through, they make it big afterwards. And many of them do, like a super high proportion of people come through, you know, relative to the odds in general. And what that means is you are anointers. That is exactly who you are. You are maybe the most important anointers in this field. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, you know, ground zero for the status dynamic, because a comic comes in and a central point in the book. And I don't know, I mean, let's turn the interview around. I'm going to ask you a question, Kelly.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So a central assertion in the book I would make is that, you know, there's like this whole crop of people who want to get in. Right. Mm-hmm. And you have to choose, like, that's your job. Mm-hmm. You just said it, you have to choose, but you could have chosen three different people, and there's still a good shot that they make it, right? It's like the key step in the process isn't the talent. I mean, these people are good, but there are lots of them who are good. It's getting mm-hmm. chosen by you.
Yes.
And then when that happens, you launch careers, and that's what the book is about.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not fair. There absolutely are really fantastic people who didn't get that credit. I recall as a younger man in this position, getting really pissed off when people would put Second City on their resume and they weren't Second City. And like we all did. Mm-hmm. And I don't care anymore. I mean, I'm older. I have other interests, and I don't pick the talent anymore. But for a period of time, that was very true. And I also tell you that one of my realizations after I stepped down, so I stepped down like in 2015, wrote my book, Yes And, and then I've really been like in the behavioral science world, neuroscience world, like that and combining all these things. But realizing one of the reasons I stepped down is I realized I was going to get credit or good reviews for everything I touched because I had been doing it so long, not because I deserved it.
There it is. That's the Matthew effect in this book. There's central concept in the book is called the Matthew effect. And that's it in a nutshell. It's like when you have high status, there's often a presumption that whatever you choose or whatever you do is high quality. So, you know, because you're in this seat, the choices that you make are right. And there's the self-fulfilling prophecy element to it, because once you choose them, then the whole world pays attention to that set of comedians. And then, you know, I'm assuming they get staff and they get help and they get, like, you know, support and they get money and they get endless opportunities, and it all happens, and so it all kind of spirals and feeds on itself in a virtuous cycle that pushes people up. And you know, that is definitely true in any of the kind of human capital talent businesses, but particularly the ones where like traditional celebrity is at play, like it is in the world of actors or comedians or writers or artists, or like these are all places where you need to catch this break if you're the talent. And when you catch the break, You often have a whole push, like an engine behind you that pushes you up the status hierarchy, which isn't based on the fact that you've gotten so much better at your craft. It's all the things that happen when you've been anointed, you know, by Kelly in Second City.
Yep, that's totally true. Let's talk about how this plays out in a completely different industry, because it's a great story. You talk about Matthew Coop Cooper. Can you tell? He got into wine and started following Robert Parker, who people should know is the sort of the wine god of what's the next great wine you should go out and buy.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a chapter in the book actually called The Anointers, like you, Kelly. But one of the really fascinating ones is a guy, Robert Parker, who he's fascinating. So he's a wine critic, but many people believe, like, when he was at his prime, he was, across kind of all of the cultural markets, he was the most influential person, like, in terms of, so he was such the dominant voice in wine. He was the taste-making, king-making, and also eviscerating function in wine, because, you know, he could say, I hate it as much as he loved it. And then the opposite things happens, like chops the legs off of the economic value of wine. But anyways, this is just one of my favorite stories. So Coop is a super personable guy. I met him. He's an entrepreneur. He started a biotech company. And so I met him in a completely different walk of life. He had this amazing story, and I'll try to tell it as succinctly as possible, but he was a college kid. He got interested in wine. He went and got a PhD in toxicology. He didn't have very much money, but he started flipping wine. Like, he would find a deal. He tells a story about how he found the case of the Premier Cru of a Premier Cru. I forget what it was, a Lafite Rothschild or something, in the basement of a liquor barn in Kentucky, buys it and flips it. And so he's like, wait, I mean, there's an arbitrage here. Like, I'm taking mm-hmm. wine out of this. No one knows what this is. And he's kicking around the industry, and then he hears a rumor, which is that Robert Parker is going to go to Australia and rate Australian wines for the first time, which he's never done before. So Cooper then goes back and buys a bunch of copies of the Wine Advocate, or has a bunch of copies of the Wine Advocate, pairs it to bottles, and starts tasting wine. By now, he's a very good wine taster. And what he's doing is he's perfecting Parker's palate.
Yeah.
So he's not, he's literally trying to figure out, okay, I drink this wine, I taste this wine, Parker's going to give this a 98, or Parker's going to give this a 91, which is a massive swing in value, right? He then goes to Australia, literally front runs Parker to Australia, goes around the winemaking regions, goes to all of these, you know, up and coming vineyards, small vineyards mostly, tastes the wine, and anything that he knows, or he believes he knows, that he believes that Parker's going to love, he buys. Brings it back home, puts it on a shipping container, brings it back home, auctions it off, gets a huge return, like the week after the Wine Advocate comes out. But here's the thing, and this is just the essence of the book. So his best return was on, like, I can't remember the vineyard's name. It's like Muckety Muck Duck Shiraz, yeah, or something like that. Like, it's got a pretty ridiculous name. It's a very good wine. It is before Parker comes around. Coop pays $60 a bottle for this. But Parker loves it. And it's pretty rare. So it gets a 99 or 100 in the Wine Advocate. And he ends up auctioning the wine like 3 weeks or a month after he bought it for, I think it was $1,300 a bottle. So it goes from $60 a bottle to $1,300 a bottle. But it's literally, and this is the key thing, it is the same bottle of wine. Like, nothing's changed. Like, the product, the quality, the merit of the product is literally identical, you know, a month ago as it is today, right? It's just aged a month, but that's it. It's the same bottle of wine. But when it gets Parker's imprimatur, just like when a comedian gets Second City's mm-hmm. imprimatur, its value skyrockets on the market because you guys have the power to anoint.
Yeah, that's wild. We just had Morgan Housel on the podcast, who's got a great new book called The Art of Spending Money. And we actually talked about wine, because I'm kind of a wine guy. He's not. He's like, I can't tell the difference. So it's like, and his whole book's premise is like, you know, our relationship with money is not great. We really should spend money on the things that we actually care about, as opposed to what you're talking about, which is, oh, it's got this label on it. So, like, he talks about, like, worry about the inside of your house as opposed to the outside of your house, which I thought was kind of interesting. There is a thing you talk about, and it's early in the book, because it's talking about the shortcuts, the heuristics, all the things that we do. And it relates to an idea here that we've been discussing, and I have been seeing cropping up in literature, in the literature, scientific literature. So my wife, Anne, talks about, as a director at Second City, you know, we create these shows in front of audiences. We're turning over shows in front of audiences. There's always a point where the show is what we call a good enough show. My bosses hate this. The owners have always hated this because they demand quite rightly excellence. And my thing back to them is 100% excellence is impossible, especially when you're creating original work. There has got to be a period where good enough is okay. And you talk about good enough as well in this regard as just a thing that sort of, I think, we have to have that exist because there's no way it could be, you know, 100% all the time.
Yeah, I mean, there's absolutely no way. So, I mean, no, you're thinking about a show. I'm thinking about a book.
Like, yeah,
you know, writing a book is an impossible task if it has to be perfect, because it never will be, right?
Right.
And so, and when you take on a project like this, actually, it's hard to end it, right? I mean, you just have to really, you kind of just have to get sick of it. There's, you know, no one will say this, but you just kind of have to get sick of it, because you can go back endlessly and fiddle and improve, and you hear something new that you want to incorporate, or you want to make it more concise, or you want to make it funny, or you want to do whatever, but that will never end. But that's, you know, generally true of all choice. Like, we just, there are just too many options in the world, and we don't have the capacity to consider them. Sometimes it's literally impossible to consider the options. Like take a book, for instance, is a great example. You know, this is the old adage that's so great, which is, you know, don't judge a book by the cover. But how else are you going to judge a book? Like,
right.
You know, the great thing about Anointed, and the reason everyone should own it, is I spend so much time working with the Simon & Schuster art department on the cover, because everybody should judge it by the cover.
I mean, that's right. That's right.
You know, because you can't read it first. You're not going to do that, right? I mean, and so you have limited information and incomplete information when you make choices and when you work on things. And this is where status comes into play, right? It has this enormous influence on what you choose, because it's like, it's what you attend to and it's how you evaluate something. It becomes how we evaluate something when evaluating the product itself is challenging.
Let's talk about the ends of books. They normally suck. I read at least two books a week, a lot in the sort of business book, and people run out of their ideas, and you could just tell they're running out of steam. Kind of doesn't matter based on what we know about how many people actually finish books, because it is a tiny, tiny number. I always finish the books. I did not see your last chapter coming.
Yeah, no,
there was nothing. You should be very proud of the fact that I'm like, what? Because I always read this out loud. I annoy my wife so much because I read a lot on the weekend at home, and she's reading in her thing, and she's reading some sort of like memorizing poetry and reading plays. And I'm, you know, and I'm spouting out the, you know, this other stuff, which she's interested in as well. We talk a lot about AI, especially at Second City right now, because we're probably one of the few creative institutions that might be able to play with that concept, not as creating content, but in other ways. You think AI could be helpful in evening the score?
Yeah, I mean, AI. So if you get me started on this, I'm never going to stop. I mean,
let's go. We got some time. We're good.
I mean, I appreciate that. I mean, the ending is. You know, we went from the veil of ignorance to AI in the ending. So I mean, You know, so AI is going to change, in my view, many things about most things. And that's probably an understatement. So it's going to change the status system, and it's going to do it in many different ways. And it's going to phase, right? I mean, so I think we're going to walk through these periods of AI. Like, AI at the moment is having a dramatic effect on things already. Like, if you just stop today, it's hugely important on what's happening in the world.
Yeah.
What it's doing today is very different than what it will be doing in 5 years, would be my bet. And so, With respect to status, and I've been busy, like I've been writing op-eds the last few weeks about it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you, I'm kind of optimistic about AI and status. Mm-hmm. But I'm very concerned about AI in general. Mm-hmm. Because I think the workplace dynamic's going to be extremely difficult and it's going to come on fast and hard. But one thing is that AI, like we know this, right? It is an incredible equalizer. So let me give you an example. Like I'm a high school kid, I'm inner city, didn't have a great education up to now, don't have a lot of love and support in the family, you know, all the things. So I'm a, you know, South Chicago kid, that kind of that kind of an upbringing. And now I'm writing an essay to go to college. So the essay I can write today in that situation is very different than the essay I could have written 10 years ago, right? All I need is access to a state-of-the-art AI system. And then I type in a prompt and I get I get something that's like, you know, it's probably going to be very good. And a year from now, it's going to be amazing, right? I mean, what you can get now is much better than what you could get last year, and what you're going to be able to get next year is much better than you could get right now. So what is that? That's equalization, right? I mean, that's an incredible equalizing function. Now that's a, on one side of it. On the other side of it, if you think about the consequence of that, they're extreme, right? Because we use writing and other output to assess the merit of a person. Like we're like, this is a window into the brain, but it isn't anymore. Right. And this is, and so because it's such an equalizer, it's created this massive evaluative problem. Like if you're in the world of sorting people, and I think you're going to see this in comedy as well, because my guess is you train up an AI system on the history of comedy, and it's going to produce very funny jokes, right? So it's like, you know, it's kind of who's the writer in the world. And what that tends to do is, and now we're back to one of the core premises in the book, which is, If I'm looking at something and I can't tell how good it is, right? And it, when it's wine, it's because we don't have the palate and because there's no objective standard of what's good, right? If it's art, it's because there's no objective standard of what's good, and most of us aren't educated to make those judgments. If it's an auto mechanic, we're kind of in the same place, right? We have no idea. So we don't know if we got a good service or not, right? I mean, even if the car doesn't work, it doesn't mean that we necessarily got bad service. So we have all of these evaluative problems, and that's when we fall back to relying on the status of the person who is associated with everything. And so what will happen, I believe, in the short term is pedigree becomes even more important. Because what you can know about, I mean, suppose it's comedy and we now have this great assistant who's producing like a lot of what's funny. Okay. Well, what we can know is, did someone go through Second City or not? Were they trained?
Right. Right.
If everybody's funny, right, then how do we sort them? We sort them based on whether they went through Second City or not, and whether they went to this high school or that high school and the whole way through. So, I mean, I think in the short run, what AI is going to do is actually going to make, it's going to equalize output, but it's going to create a heavier reliance in evaluative frameworks on pedigree, because everybody is concerned that it's the AI creating the output and not the person whose name is tied to it. Does that make sense?
It does. I have been making the argument, this is my argument why AI is never going to replace comedians, and very specifically improv comedians, is because it is predictive. And the whole idea with comedy is surprise. And when you look at the elements of comedy, so my wife's comedy theory, she's got a book coming out in a month, is it's three parts. It's some level of pain, some level of distance, and some level of recognition. And it's like a mixing board on there. Mm-hmm. And then you add in the five other people in your ensemble of six. Then you add in the audience who's given you a suggestion. And then you add in the fact that this is created in the moment with all those various inputs. That is going to be extremely hard to replicate. Beyond which, I don't want to go to a club to see six computers on a stage.
Exactly. So, I mean, so that's a, I mean, this is a, again, we will never end this conversation, but this is one of my strong theses about AI is that is that already most people are unaware of how much of the content on your phone and on the internet already is fake.
Like, yes,
an immense,
yes,
amount of it, an immense, yes, amount of it is. And the text to videos and the text to image generators are so good, and they're getting better at lightning speed. Like, it's unbelievable what you could do. So we're going to get to this world where you're watching your Instagram feed and you have no idea, like, what's, you know, what's this or what's that, and what's that going to do? And when you read a book, by the way, in the future, you'll never know the author wrote the book. I mean, that's, you know, that's where we are. I mean, whether anyone wants to talk about it or not, you'll never know how much of the ideas or even the literal text the author is responsible for. And what that will do, I believe, is it's going to create this premium demand for things that are authentically human. And improv is a great example of that.
Yeah.
I actually think that the world's going to say, okay, well, that commercial I just watched and that Netflix series I just watched was some text to video thing. I don't want to see that anymore. I want to go see people being creative. But you need to do that in an environment where you actually know it's the people being creative. And there literally isn't a better context for that than improv, right? Because nothing's pre-scripted.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wonder if then, you know, what I think, I did my thesis on the Beats. So you start to wonder, like, are we going to go back to Allen Ginsberg reading Howl in a cafe and that gaining this? And there's a certain beauty to that, right? That is an American tradition of this oral sort of reading in these places. And I it doesn't bother me, that idea of the interplay between that text and the human in a live space.
And if you think about it, you know, it's already kind of gotten that way. Like, I mean, I'm spend a lot of time in New York City, and, like, you know, the price of high culture, right? I mean,
yeah,
the price of high culture, it's very expensive to spend. Like, a live comedy show is unbelievably expensive.
It is now.
And, you know, so is, but so is the opera or play or something. And, you know, you ask yourself why that versus going to see a movie or whatever. That's way less experience, way less expensive. And, you know, one of the answers is, of course, the experience of being in a room with a bunch of people and, you know, having an occasion to dress up or dress down or whatever it is, to laugh with friends. But I think already it's this, like, I want to see something that's just purely, like, live, authentically human. And my strong bet is, like, we're gonna have that desire even, you know, much, much more intensely over the next 5-10 year period, as other content becomes outstandingly good but is machine generated.
It's funny. Maybe I'm going to ask you for a yes and story in a moment, which is our last question. I'll explain it. But it was funny. So my dad was a radio guy, and for years here in WGN, 30 years, and a huge jazz fan. And he used to, like, MC big bands at, do you remember Old Orchard in Skokie?
I do. And I remember, yeah. I love the jazz standards, and, you know, my years in Chicago was, like, listening to jazz and walking by WGN studio on the studio on
Michigan Avenue. Yeah. Yeah. So his office was right next to the studio that looked out on there. So I got stuff from him, which was great, but then I was starting to curate on my own, and I discovered this Pablo label, and there's so much good stuff on that. And then, of course, Blue Note. And you were just like, well, if it's on Blue Note, I'd like 95% I'm going to like it. And I did. But then as you get older and you dig even deeper, you're like, oh, there's so much good stuff that maybe didn't surface. And even pop music there, you know, now that we have Spotify, it's like, you know, it's the biggest Tower Records you could ever go into. And one of the things I loved about early Pandora was it was introducing me truly to the kinds of sounds I liked, so that I discovered, these 25 Canadian singer-songwriters I never would have listened to. So maybe the technology also opens up. I hadn't actually thought about the opening up and the opportunity the way you frame it in this book, because everyone's kind of talking about the other terrible things, especially in academia, and the worry of, I mean, my wife is a college professor, and she spots the papers all the time that were written by AI.
Yeah, I mean, it's so, so many reactions to that, and we don't have a lot of time. I mean, let me say a couple things. So one is, AI is going to be terrible for many things, and it's also going to be amazing. Like, such a mixed blessing. You know, there are so many things that are going to get better for AI. One, two is, I spent so much time with the early Pandora. I mean, with the founder and and they had this great, so it's a great example where AI is going to be amazing. So they had this, Pandora had this amazing idea, which is they had what they called musical DNA. Mm-hmm. And they kind of hand coded up a matrix of like 300 musical elements. And then they would do a bunch of math on the matrix and identify like quantitative similarity between pieces of music. But it was all kind of hand done at first. Mm-hmm. And now like an AI system can do that, like, you know, at such a deeper level and instantaneously. So we are going to get to this, like from a discovery standpoint, it is going to radically change the discoverability of everything. So that will be one, and we can see that already, like that's already happening with sort of the current step where we are right now with AI agents, but they're going to get much better over the next 12 to 24 months. And I think that's going to be one of the many ways in which AI is going to enrich our lives, right? We are going to discover things that really appeal to us in ways that we can't right now, because right now we rely on Blue Note or Second City or Simon & Schuster or The Wine Advocate or whatever, which are the anointers, which reduce these huge consideration sets to just have us focus on a tiny fraction of the products and the content that's available out there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the Rolex will exist and the other thing will exist too. All right. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. The idea is, you know, in improvisation, you don't get anywhere by saying no. And you actually don't get that far by saying yes. You got to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. That allows you to work from a place of abundance. So I think we all have these moments in our lives, right? Where like we kind of want to say no, but we say yes, and then something cool happens. Do you have a story for us in that regard?
Okay, so I'm going to tell you the very first thing that comes to mind?
Please.
I need to say yes and more often.
Oh, interesting.
Because you're totally right. Like there's so much wisdom in that. Way more often, in fact. You know, I've actually had that thought quite a bit the last few months. I mean, the thing that comes first to mind is I got a message from a woman called Layla Seca during the height of the pandemic. And the message said, it had a lot of expletives in it, so I'll leave it out, but it said like, you don't know who the F I am, and like, you have no reason to talk to me and you probably shouldn't or whatever, but I have this idea. And I would say normally I probably would say like, okay, this sounds wacky. So no, but I think because it was the pandemic and because of a few references she had in there, I said yes. And it turned into something that just, you know, became a huge part of my life for quite some time. And it was just at this moment in the pandemic when I think it was just incredibly healthy for me and for the people that were involved in it. But it was but it's these, you know, kind of random things that come over the transom that I nearly always say no to. And this one got a yes, and boy, did it really, I mean, it's kind of unbelievable. All the follow on from that. So, but honestly, my first response is let's do some more yes ands.
Yeah. I mean, look, we're everything's me search, you know, like, and I can be a no machine, and I've really been trying to focus on that lately. I got an invitation. This thing came out of the blue from a thing called the Corkins Institute. And they're like, we're going to fly you. You got to fly yourself to Albuquerque, but then we're going to pick you up and 17 other people that you don't know. And you're going to spend a week hiking, and there's meditation and all the other thing. And it's like, this is probably too woo woo for me as a human being. And I like my things, and I want to be in control of stuff. But I said, yes. I just got like the list of the other people who are going to be there. And it's a wild list of like, I would never choose to spend time with these humans in a place I've really never been. And I leave a week from Sunday. But the thing I do know is I'm going to have some stories.
Yeah, you are. And, so So congratulations. I would never do that, but I have been to Albuquerque many times, and New Mexico is beautiful.
Yeah, that's right here.
Like, it's amazing. It's amazing terrain, though. You love the topology. I mean, no matter what, you get to spend a week in probably in what will surely be amazing and foreign nature when you're not used to it.
Right. You lived in Chicago, so just the idea of actually seeing stars.
Yes. I mean, we have too much about Chicago, I guess, but I mean, I will never forget driving into Chicago and you're like 4 hours away and you see this dome of light.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, the city generates so much light and it's flat. So there's nothing blocking your view when you're a long way away from the city, but you see it approaching from so far away because it's the light. I mean, it's incredible, but yeah, no stars in Chicago.
No stars in the sky, plenty of other stars. And then the Lakeshore Drive thing, especially going, you know, cause I had a program at University of Chicago. I'm working on something up there now. I always feel good making that drive, going, you know, and then getting into Hyde Park. And it's just like, it's awe inspiring actually,
yeah,
in terms of this city that you have this. A friend of mine who works at Second City, our head of marketing, she's from Belgium, and she's based in New York, but she came and brought her family for a visit to Chicago. And she was like, you can actually swim in this water. And I'm like, yeah, you can. She's like, it's unbelievable. Why do people not know about this? I'm like, well, the military is coming next week, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 Well, that is a topic for another show for sure. But yeah, it's an amazing city. It's magical in both directions. I mean, I used to love the drive back. I mean, you know, it's just it's glorious. And then the drive north. I mean,
up to Northwestern. Where do you go? It just keeps going. Yeah. Yeah. All right. The book is terrific. It's called Anointed, The Extraordinary Effects of Social Status in Winner Takes Most World. Toby Stewart, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thanks, Kelly. I loved it. Appreciate it.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.